Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you all for joining us once more on Queensberry Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of Queensberry Rules, and today
James Foley of Bad Left Hook and I are going to be welcoming back the Brian Campbell of ESPN, who made his ESPN debut this last week on Friday Night Fights. It was pretty awesome. In any event, he's coming on today. He's going to join us. Always a fun time. We're going to be probably taking a dump or two on Danny Garcia versus Rod Salka, the matchup anyway. But we'll get into that stuff, and we're going to be getting into the Showtime card. As a matter of fact, I think that Mr. Campbell is calling me right now. Brian.
Yeah, hi. I was calling about the ad in the paper for the Ultimate Sack.
You came to the right place.
Yeah, beer, the man, my man.
Oh, no, you, sir, are the man. I just wanted to say, you know, before Foley even gets here, I wanted to call it out. But congratulations, sir, for, dude, you're the guy. You're the guy now. ESPN, you're the guy. So congratulations. That was awesome this last week.
I appreciate that. The only problem is, you know, Foley didn't see it. He's a great friend like that. He doesn't watch on Fridays, you know?
He never does, ever. He's pretty much just, like, morally against it, I think.
Yeah, you know, I'd like to get to the bottom of that in this episode if you had the time, but I'm not really the producer, so let's just keep going.
Total hashtag purist.
So what's happening today, dude?
Well, I'm really reeling from this fight of the year, card of the year type thing we had this last weekend. We had both, actually. We had the card of the year and the fight of the year. You know, if you take the hashtags into account. But, yeah, it was trying times this weekend, I think, for boxing, at least for most people who watched the mainstream type of stuff. Tell me, what was I don't want to open up with too much ripping comedy or anything, but what was your overall impression of Danny Garcia, Rod Salka? I mean, break it down for us.
You know, I mean, coming in, that's as bad as a card on paper as you know you're really going to see at that level in a prime cable showcase. So you come in with really low expectations. You come in hoping that something has to happen, right? Like it can't play out as bad as it looks on paper. Like it just can't happen that way. And I think all that negative attention almost, you know, sort of helped the card. And as you sort of saw today when the ratings came out, I think that played into it to a certain degree. But in the way it played out, I mean, it was just an awful card from top to bottom. You know, the favorite won in every bout and won dominantly or won in a situation where maybe, you know, you could have questioned they shouldn't have got the decision and they still got it wide on the undercard. But when you got to those TV bouts, it was just one domination after another. And I do have to say something, like, and I talked a lot about it in the build-up and in the aftermath of how much of a no-win situation it put a guy like Danny Garcia. And even though the crowd of, you know, 7,000 at the Barclays cheered on that knockout of Rod Salka like it was, you know, like he had just hit a walk-off home run, and even though he went to the corner pounding his chest, and even though it was an impressive knockout, and it's one that will, you know, be in his highlight reels along with the Morales one and the Khan one forever, there was definitely a sort of grimy feeling. You know, it just didn't feel right because Salka took a really bad beating and it really exposed why he shouldn't have been in there. And it was just one of those spots, you know, where the corner, Paul Spadafore, is trying to get on the apron and throw the towel and he's not getting the referee's attention in time. And Salka took those extra two shots. And, not to try to be this way, but it felt like watching a schoolyard brawl and where it's just a complete mismatch and you feel bad for the kid getting pounded. It didn't have to be that way.
Well, you know, it's always, there are so many things that, you know, just today in general they get so broken down and compartmentalized and just kind of cut and dry meat, you know, in news stories so that it can fit 140 characters and whatnot. So, you know, there's a lot of different black and white storylines going on here. Well, I guess a couple different, I should say. But in reality, there's a lot of different things going on behind the scenes, and it kind of makes it interesting, even though the fight itself wasn't that interesting. For instance, like you said, the fact that it was basically a no-win situation for Garcia, and then that kind of trickled into, I don't know if you caught it, but Mr. David Greissman's, you know, pretty grilling interview yeah. of Eric Gomez, and also a bit of Danny Garcia, too. It really came off to me like, if you didn't see it anyway, or those who didn't see it, basically it was David Greissman, our buddy from Boxing Scene, pressing Eric Gomez, who's the matchmaker, I think, and also VP of Golden Boy, with Danny Garcia on basically why the fight was made. And in any event, the whole point of me bringing it up is that they both really seemed like frustrated, really frustrated. I don't know if they had just been getting bombarded for the last 15 minutes about this and they were just kind of getting pissed. But regardless, I think that they've had to really answer a lot of questions about, you know, why the fight was happening and the card and all this type of stuff. And meanwhile, you do kind of have to remember that there is a fighter that does have to go in there and do his job in the middle of all this. And then also there's another guy, too, who was brought in basically to lose and did. So I feel bad for Rod Salga. There's a lot of different things going on here, you know, but the bottom line was that, yeah, it felt kind of B-movie-ish. It was not good.
You know, and Greissman's interview with him was fantastic. I had a similar talk with Gomez probably minutes before that at ringside where, you know, it was essentially asked to him by another reporter next to me why this fight was made. And it's like the responses he had were so non-believable, you know, this fight is being made because Garcia cleaned out the division. And it's like, and there's nobody left for him to fight. You know, and it's like, come on, you know, that's not the case. So it just reeked of the worst-case scenario stereotype that people look at the whole Al Haymon situation in, because it reeked of that, man, this guy really is controlling everything, and everyone's not really happy. The fighters, they talk, you know, both Garcia and Peterson talked during the week that they wish they were fighting each other. All the fans wish they were. The people from Showtime and Golden Boy sort of put on the mask and gave you the, you know, the company answers, but it didn't really seem like they even believed in their own company answers. And like you said, there's a lot of different layers to this one fight and what really happened behind the scenes. And it really causes you to start to make a couple different theories of why this fight was made. I think there's a couple roads you can go.
Well, so leading directly into that, I mean, putting it plain, why was this fight made? I mean, the answer would seem to be, well, where this is kind of like the slow cook for Danny Garcia versus Lamont
right.
Peterson. But I mean, why was this fight made? Why was this card even put on? You know, why waste time like this?
I think you can go the optimist route and say it's the slow cook and they're building up toward the Peterson fight, and hopefully they're building up toward a Broner Matisse fight, and hopefully the winners fight down the road. You know, and this becomes – it turned this last Saturday's card into almost like a World Wrestling Federation house show from the 80s, or like a, you know, Saturday morning wrestling superstars where you're going to see squash match after squash match, and you're just waiting 6 months down the line for WrestleMania to come and you finally see a good fight. It could be that. Or it could be, you know, go the conspiracy route angle and say, you know, Haymon is taking these fighters that are still under Golden Boy contract and is maybe hoping to wait his time for them to fulfill their obligation, so in one large match he can take all his big-name fighters and go wherever he is rumored to be going, you know, whether it be create his own promotion, go to another network, go to another promoter, whatever the deal. But I thought, you know, there's this third thing, Patrick, that's out there. You know, was this just a way to try to hit that casual fan and just say, you know, I think a lot of people thought the Mauricio Herrera fight was supposed to be that showcase, knockout, setup opportunity to showcase Danny to both the Puerto Rican market and potentially the casual fan as a way to lift him up and say, here's the next guy that could possibly face Mayweather. You know, here he is. You saw him on Mayweather's undercard, and he upset Matisse, and, you know, here's this guy. And that failed. So was this just a... look, we're not going to fool around anymore. Let's give him that highlight reel knockout because we know the casual fans are not only going to watch this card, we know the hardcore fans are not only going to watch this card, they're going to buy every pay-per-view we throw at them, because the casual fans are, the hardcore fans are the ones that still, you know, present that number that still buys it no matter what. But let's go after the casual fan. So let's show him, showcase Knockout, some guy who doesn't deserve to be in there, but the casual fan doesn't know that, and let's showcase the great Danny Jacobs story underneath it. Let's showcase another good, credible guy in Lamont Peterson, and, you know, the casual fan doesn't know any better, so let's give them this imprint in their mind, and we build toward the future. You know, I don't know, and it's so frustrating.
You know, and I'm not going to lie, I a few times used the excuse that, you know, I wrote up the fights for Queensberry Rules, so I watched it. But, you know, the reality is that I probably would have watched it even if I hadn't written them up for Queensberry Rules. That's just kind of how it is, and I think that sentiment where, you know, there's a fairly decent-sized chunk of us that are going to watch the fights no matter what, that kind of gets taken advantage of by the networks. And I mean, from a business perspective, I get that. I understand that. But from a perspective of the fans being consumers, the fans also being people who are looking just to kind of be satisfied, it's not a good deal. It's just not, you know, and especially, I mean, I guess if somebody's going to be tuning in casually and seeing, you know, these guys get just violently knocked out and that's what they're tuning in for, okay, you know, fine, but that's just not really a good representation of what boxing is.
Well, we know Al's a genius, right? I mean, the guy, you don't get this much control where it's so obvious that you have this much control without, you know, I mean, he's the brains behind Floyd making this incredible run on the business side, you know, making himself into this level of a star and getting, you know, this much control and this level of money thrown his way for each fight. So the guy's brilliant. So I don't think it's, you know, he didn't think the card was going to be this bad, or, you know, I think you have to really, if you're going to play that, go down that road and try to pick his brain. He's way smarter than all of us. So there's some angle with this card. You know, I don't think it was, hey, let me see what I can make Showtime put on the air, right? You know, like, I don't think, you know, or let me hold this over Showtime's head to prove that I have the power. There's some kind of angle. But for the most part, all of the angles lead to the fan as the one being unhappy, right?
It sure seems that way. You know, and there is something that I probably would have forgotten to bring up if not, you know, for the folks tweeting back at me as I'm kind of like, you know, tweeting stuff out during the show. But a few people mentioned, and it was noticeable how much bigger Danny Garcia was than Rod Salka. I mean, going in, we knew that. We knew that Rod Salka was not really a natural 140-pounder and blah, blah, blah. But when they actually got into the ring, I don't know if Danny Garcia is really just rehydrating a lot or something, but it was a total size mismatch. I have not seen a size mismatch like that since, you know, James Bagg and his ultimate sack versus me and Mom.
Or people are bringing up Gotti and Joey Camacci, right? Like, that's another. I mean, you know, and the fact that it was. Here's the two facts that are even worse to go along with your point was that they raised it up to 142 pounds. So Danny, you know, doesn't have to even sweat it out if there is a sweat out to get down to 140. You're facing a guy who has no power to begin with, and then you're facing a guy who is so, you don't want to say bad, but Casalco, you know, he's headlined a showbox card. He's obviously, you know, he's just a different kind of fighter that wouldn't match up well in this. He's not bad. It's just that he's so not ready to be in this spot that even the sanctioning bodies that would not put their name behind it and say that this can be a title fight. And, like, that's unbelievable. That's, like, the one point that's, of course, been mentioned a few times, but really hasn't been hammered home by anybody. The money-grubbing sanctioning body said this is not a legitimate fight. And they still went on with it as a 10-round main event. You know, and then you're sitting there at ringside covering the fight, you see Spadafora walk out with his cool haircut, and you're like, why are we watching Spadafora and Garcia? Like, can he tag in? Because that's actually a decently credible fight on the same level as Garcia Herrera, right? You know, it's not that bad.
No joke. Well, you know, and to take that analogy, you know, and kind of, you know, mirror that slightly, hey, even Mrs. Bika got married, you know, but the sanctioning bodies won't touch Garcia Salka.
Hey-o.
Sorry, Mrs. Bika. Sorry. It was bad, though. It was fairly embarrassing. And it was just, you know, there are embarrassing things that happen in boxing all the time. But there are those particular types of instances or cards or whatever that are, you know, in particular, just difficult to defend. Difficult to, you know, if you're watching something like that with a group of your friends, you're kind of just going,
yeah. And when the fighters aren't even on board. Exactly. And the fighters are not even on board. They're not selling you. It was almost like Garcia and Peterson didn't know what to say in the post-fight interview. Almost like they didn't know which angle to go. Because they're asked, do you want to fight the other guy next? And like, yeah, I want to fight him, but we'll have to see how it goes. You know, so it's almost like they're almost completely giving the appearance that they're being left out of this, too. It's, you know, like we can spin in circles. We can go a whole week just getting upset about this. But, you know, we'll probably forget about this card in a few weeks or a few months. But we almost shouldn't, because it just comes off as an extreme waste of time. And, you know, luckily for Showtime, the ratings weren't really that bad where it sticks out as this big sore thumb, because, like we talked about, the fans are going to keep tuning in. But, man, after what was just an amazing 2013, where not only was it one good fight after another, not only was Showtime sort of taking this leap to try to get up on HBO's level, so they had a lot to prove, and HBO, on the other hand, was standing its guard and had a lot to come back with, but every week, even the fights that you weren't excited about lived up to expectations and more. And it wasn't that I thought 2014 could repeat or top that, but I didn't think it was going to take this hard of a nosedive, because when you look at what has been on cable on either HBO or Showtime, it has really not been good. We've had too many pay-per-views, and especially on Showtime, there's just been so many one-sided matchups. Most of them that they've been lucky turned into decent fights, but man, this is like feeling like 2012 all over again, which was a bad year. You know, there was so many PED things that canceled big fights. There was so many injury situations. It was just, you know, not a great year for the sport.
Yeah, well, I mean, there have been instances in the past, too, where we've come to, you know, situations, especially kind of like right around the middle of the year like this. Someone had brought up, it might even have been Foley, but 2004. 2004 is, you know, was a pretty, that year epitomized the kind of too many pay-per-views, not enough quality yeah. matchups type of thing. And regardless, the point is that, yeah, it's, thus far is just really a letdown from 2013 that closed so strong, especially with Maidana Broner and that, you know, the infamous reciprocal hump. That was awesome.
And it went back to the last 3 months of 2012, starting from September on the same night when you had Martinez Chavez and then you had that good Canelo Lopez card on the same night. From that point forward, going through Pacquiao Marquez for, you know, it was like a year and a half of just, you know, everything was awesome, and despite this cold yeah. war going on, you know, and now in 2014, there's been certain things that are actually promising. Certain things have happened from, you know, the Golden Boy crumbling a little but opening up doors for new opportunities. There's fights that are being made that you wouldn't have thought. I mean, Kovalev-Hopkins is a huge example. A lot of great things are happening that maybe down the road will give you some good things, but it's enough for two grown men like you and I to just sit here and almost whine about this year kind of kicking you right in the ultimate sack, you know?
Yeah, right in the ultimate sack. So, that said, actually, I don't know where the hell Foley is. Foley's lagging. He told me earlier that he actually was kind of caught up in some, you know, some stuff at his job that he actually gets paid to do. So I can't really argue with that. But
he said he texted me that he was thinking about getting one of those South Coast Mitsubishi hats. So he was going to swing by the dealership and sort of check it out.
I thought there was a possibility that he was caught up with the Latin Goonies, but that was just kind of speculation. But I actually before he even jumps on here and tells me he didn't watch it, did you get a chance to watch that strawweight unification bout this last weekend?
I did today. I finally got on board today and wow. I mean, dude, wow. And it got better round by round, right? There was a point around the sixth round where I was like, wow, this is a really good fight, and it's crazy. And it's so crazy that I really couldn't tell you what happened the last six rounds because it's just crazy. And then it just sort of escalated and got better, and it got better. And it was two guys, man, that just went for it. Dude, you know that – okay, you know when you go to the gym and there's, like, the heavy bag in the corner and everybody is afraid to use it because they don't want to look like a loser and look like they have no form and don't know what they're doing? And then, like, that one dude – and there's this dude at work – who like has a mullet and totally doesn't look like he fits the part, he'll just go over and pick up the gloves. The guy doesn't care at all. And he'll put on the timer for 3 minutes, and for three straight minutes, he'll just throw body shots at the bag as fast as he can. And, like, you know, no defense, no form, whatever. That was two guys in the ring in a title unification fight doing that for 12 rounds. It was amazing.
Yeah, Well, first of all, that first wow from you, that totally was – you channeled – Teddy Atlas. I put the lime in the coconut. I mix it all up. I put the lime in the coconut. I drink it all down. It was an appropriate time I had to. I'm sorry. But, yeah, it was – that was great stuff. It really was. I mean, I I wasn't really sure about what was going to happen going into it because of the I didn't know anything about the U.S. television situation. And then, of course, our buddy Cliff Rold is one of the people who follows the lower weight classes like the Dickens, I say.
Dude, he's
and
the ambassador for the low weight classes.
He basically
the Twitter
is.
Ambassador.
He basically is. And he clued us in that it was going to be on. He said that this is a network that's around and shows boxing all the time. I had to find it on my, you know, guide. And then when I saw that I had it, I was like, oh, I have that. Indeed, I
yeah,
had
it's like
it.
Down
so
past
the
nudie channels that you don't normally go to. It's down in that weird area, right?
Well, those are the channels that we used to be able to go to, like, in the 90s, because when you clicked by them, you could see, like, a little flash real quick of some booby or something.
Oh,
but,
you could tape the nickel.
You
tape
anymore.
The nickel down on the cable box, right? You take a piece of tape, you put the nickel on top of the power button, and you could get the little, like, squiggly views of what was going on, right?
Holy crap, I never even thought – why didn't anybody tell me this when I was, like, 11? Holy shit.
Dude, that's how I watched Bo Holyfield 1, was through the squiggly line, just like that.
Damn, so all you saw was just, you know, somebody punched. That
like,
was pretty,
I see
well,
boob, I see
to,
boob.
Yeah, well, that's pretty much what today's heavyweight division, that's what you'd be seeing when you're watching that shit. But, yeah, I mean, yeah. I didn't know anything about what was going to be happening with the U.S. television situation, and when Mr. Rold, you know, delightfully clued us in that it was going to be on that. It was called BN, I think, was the – anyway, point is, I actually wound up getting to catch it in HD. I was happy, and while I was watching it, I was just kind of like drinking a beer going, wow, these guys are just beating the ever-loving crap out of each other. It was pretty awesome.
And I'm always a little tentative when somebody's like, hey, did you see that fight of the year in France? You know, I mean, the only one that really, I think, ever lived up to the bark that people were giving it was maybe that Manchepour one. Was that the guy's name? That fight of the year from, like, 06?
Yeah, yeah. Sitchachwal versus Manchepour.
I don't know if you just had a seizure, but I think you said the names right. But, yeah, that fight lived up to it. Never since then, there's always going to be the, you know, those lower weight heads or the foreign heads or, you know, whatever, who are going to be like, man, you got to see this fight. And it almost always doesn't really live up, but, man, this one just about lived up to it. I mean, did Francisco Rodriguez Jr. throw any punch besides a powerful left hook the entire fight?
Man, I will say this. It was damn close, and I didn't really like the scores all that much. In particular, that one score that gave Takayama
only one round, I think it was. That was a little bit ridiculous, although I do tend to agree that there were a hell of a lot of close rounds that, you know, Rodriguez just kind of seemed to edge out. And so, I don't know. I don't even really know how you sit down and score that. I wasn't even really scoring it, you know. Once I saw that it was right around the, I think it was the third round when it really started just kind of taking off, I just kind of sat back and watched. I tweeted a few times during it, but that was it. And, you know, I just enjoyed. It's difficult for some people, I think, to tune into fights where you know that there's probably not going to be some type of devastating knockout. You know, overall, people just like seeing big human beings knocked down hard. So that being said, it just comes down to, are they heavyweights? Are they heavyweights? And then when you find out they're the exact opposite of heavyweights, actually, you know, at strawweight, like I said last week, which is also known as like the least a human being can weigh and still be like an effective combat, you know, machine. It's 105 pounds. You know, I weighed 105 pounds when I was like 8 years old or something. So, yeah, in any event, yeah, it's difficult for some people to get into that, but I promise you people, go look it up on YouTube. There's an HD version on there. Check it out. It's really good stuff.
Well, and this was not only a title fight, it was, you know, a really rare unification fight within the strawweight division, and you just loved how, man, these guys fought as if, not only as if this was the biggest fight of their career, which, you know, you can argue it was, but, I mean, they were fighting to the level of, man, if I don't win, I don't eat. You know, it was that kind of intensity. And, you know, we sit here and complain about the Garcia-Salco fights all we want because we don't always get these type of fights, and it was just so refreshing to see.
And I'm kind of, like, reluctant to really get into what's a unification and all that type of stuff at this point because, I don't know, especially, for example, ever since the Transnational Rankings Board came out, and it kind of made me rethink what I should be calling champion and what I shouldn't be calling champion. But regardless, I think that in the lower weight classes, it should be kind of an extenuating circumstance, as it were, just because, like you said, these type of unification fights are just very rare in lower weight classes where it seems as though guys just build up a kind of regional fan base, and that's it. There's not really much of an aspiration past that. It wasn't until, I believe it was 1990, when the first $1 million purse for anything, you know, below featherweight. In any event, I know it's tough for some people to get into, but yeah, it was meaningful, and on top of that, a very good fight.
No question about it. And it's been kind of a weird fight of the year race so far as it is. You know, a couple decent choices, nothing I think that really has been close to a slam dunk. So it was good to see a clubhouse leader and a real honest choice come out.
Hey, Mr. Campbell, I think Foley is on right now.
Nice.
What's up, fellas?
James.
You guys hear me?
Yes, sir. What's up, late Campbell?
Not much. Just got totally bent over. So kind of like boxing fans on Saturday night.
Hey-o!
Nice. Kazing!
Big game, James.
Well, we more or less almost exhausted the Garcia-Salca talk, but I figure you might have a zinger to throw at us about that one.
Nah, I don't have anything, really. I mean, it was a total waste of time, and, you know, really just pathetic that the network agreed to, spend that kind of money on it, and not much more you can really say. I don't think we learned anything from that card. I mean, literally nothing.
Well, if I'm not mistaken, Mr. Campbell's quote on that was that it was effing boo-boo, I think he called. I think that's what he said.
Yeah, effing boo-boo, that sums it up.
Probably the most complimentary thing you could say for it. You know, it just...
For
God's sake, you know, the interview with Adrian Broner was probably the best thing that happened.
Holy
and
shit,
that
man.
Was awful.
Dude,
too.
That,
horrific.
That shirt, though,
that was horrific.
Right? That shirt. Wow.
Oh, man. That
was
horrific,
for
dude.
That
looked like a tornado hit a uranium enrichment plant or something, dude. I don't know what that was.
Whoever was the first one on Twitter to make the Gordon Gartrell Cosby Show reference deserves to wear the crown. I think Raskin was the next morning with it. He may have been the most high profile who made it, but man, that was hilarious.
Oh man, that dude's fashion sense. I gotta say, he's brave. I'll give him that. That's some brave stuff to be wearing, dude. That's some serious Fresh Prince wear there. But. That said, bringing probably let's say it was the 11th worst thing on the broadcast, Lamont Peterson versus Edgar Santana. So bringing that up and going into that, so needless to say, Lamont Peterson coming out of this is probably going to be pushed towards Danny Garcia, or at least that's kind of what they're hinting at. I guess nobody really seems to be firm on it, whatever. But for the moment.
Great, the fight that we've all been waiting for.
Yes, the
I mean,
fight
even,
that's been
even that's
forever.
Like, you know, even that's like was pretty unnecessary. I mean, yeah, Peterson's solid. He's a credible contender. There's nothing special about the matchup. There's no real demand for it. I mean, Garcia beat the guy who just destroyed Peterson in 3 rounds. You know, so there's no mandate like, no, he must face Lamont Peterson. You know, no more than he must face any, you know, top 10 contender. But yeah, if you're the champion at 140, you should be defending against the top contenders, and Peterson's one of them, but it's not like some special mega fight that anyone's really been, you know, excited about or looking forward to. I mean, I don't think that Garcia should have any problem with Lamont's style or with what he does, but, you know, it's and it just definitely didn't need to be, you know, a wasted card on Showtime to try to build up to it. So, and the Peterson-Santana fight was terrible. I mean, I'm sorry, you know, it was a, whatever. I mean, you know, Santana was just completely out of his class, and it was, again, it you know, wasn't as brutal and violent as the Salka debacle, but it was still a complete waste of time, in my opinion.
Hit us with your scathing review, Campbell.
First of all, I mean, it was almost as brutal in the sense that I thought Salka took an unnecessary amount of punishment, maybe two, you know, punches too many, with that last one being, you know, brutal, especially from ringside. But Santana was, like, way too brave for his own good, because he was essentially getting to a point where he really wasn't punching back. It was just one punch for every five or six that Peterson was landed. But, man, this guy was way too brave. He was eating the most absurd stretch of body shots, completely unanswered, unblocked, that I've really ever seen. I mean, every single writer at ringside was making the, man, wouldn't want to be him the next morning urinating joke. And it was just like, man, this is getting kind of gross. Like, stop this fight. This is just like, and it was like, that was the really, you know, considering how much more competitive that fight was on paper than the Salka Garcia one, it almost made you not hate it as much. But when you really started to look at who Santana is, who he's beaten, the losses he has, the whole story, you're like, man, why are we doing this? Considering how deep that division is and how many people in that division are represented by Al Haymon, it's really a joke that we're not getting, you know, Garcia Peterson on the Floyd undercard on September 13th, or we're not getting, you know, Matisse Broner on that undercard, or we're not just seeing one great matchup after another. Man.
The whole thing was gross. I mean, you know, the underdogs really just had no chance of winning any of those fights. I mean, that's the honest truth, you know. And you know, boxing, it's not like, I mean, it's really just like an exhibition game between, you know, the San Antonio Spurs and, like, you know, a high school team or something. I mean, it was just, there was no even pretense of competition. And, you know, I agree. I mean, yeah, you know, Santana's a tougher guy. He took the punishment better, you know, so it was in a way, I mean, for me, it was less uncomfortable. You know, the Garcia-Salka fight was just, it was painful to watch. I mean, it was really genuinely uncomfortable. It was like watching and I mean, Salka is a good fighter in his own right at the level that he's on, which is obviously, you know, well beneath the world class level, the best guys in the division like Danny, but it really just looked like an amateur out there just getting destroyed by a guy who had every conceivable advantage, you know. And it was just, the fact that Garcia got paid $700,000 for that is just preposterous.
Well, let me ask you something, Foley. Like, you joined us kind of after Brian and I had talked about it, but I don't know if you caught Griceman's interviews in particular with Garcia and Gomez. He posted them a few times. Well, in any event, I wanted to see what you had to say about, for example, Gomez, and I think Steven Espinosa was defending it, not quite as aggressively. What do you think about these guys really defending this card? I mean, there's an obvious answer.
Or what are they supposed to say? You know, I mean, I mean, of course they're going to try to defend it, but they barely even could do it with a straight face, you know. And Gomez said, you know, he earned a shot. And it was like, how did he earn it? And he just didn't have an answer for it, because he didn't earn it. You know, I mean, what do you expect? I mean, they're the ones that are selling the fight, so they're not gonna badmouth their own, you know, the thing that they're responsible for. And like I had mentioned to other people, like maybe Campbell and I were talking about it, you know, that, you know, you can't, I mean, I don't blame Al Haymon. Great job. You got a guy paid $700,000 for that fight. You know, you've got Lamont Peterson making $300,000 or whatever he made for his fight. A hell of a job. The manager of the year. I mean, that's what she should be doing, right? I mean, you give these guys incredible rewards for, you know, virtually zero risk. I don't blame necessarily, you know, Golden Boy. I think they have more of a, you know, business obligation to have played their part in it. But, I mean, I really point the finger squarely at Showtime, because, you know, that there should not be this relationship between the promoters and management and the network. It has to be separate, you know, and an objective network never would have bought that fight, these fights. It was total garbage. Everybody knew it, you know?
Both, let me jump in here for a second. Before you got on, I had given three or four perspective theories of why Showtime would be so willing to do this. If you had to pick one, what's your gut feeling of why they would sign off on this?
I just don't think that they are going to say no to, I don't know if it's Al Heyman, Golden Boy. I mean, I'm assuming it's Heyman, but they obviously just can't say no to whatever he gives them. And maybe it's some kind of quid pro quo thing, like, hey, you know, I mean, Showtime has closed the gap on HBO in the last couple of years, and, you know, in large part because they've had that whole stable of fighters to work with, and they've had some nice shows. A lot of them have been kind of accidental, you know, competitive fights that we thought didn't look good on paper going into it. So they've had a nice run, and, you know, maybe it's, hey, we, you know, we did this for you in the past, now you owe us this, you know. Who knows? I mean, I don't understand. You know, if I'm Showtime and they're like, well, if you want the Peterson-Garcia fight, you're going to have to do this, I would just say I don't really care that much. But what, the Peterson-Garcia fight? That's not a huge fight. I mean, give me a break. You know, Garcia's been in bigger fights. Lamont Peterson's been in, you know, other fights that were more compelling than this. I mean, Peterson-Garcia is just a standard champion taking on, you know, a top five contender thing. It's not some great fight that we've all been clamoring for. So, you know, I have no idea why Showtime. I mean, the only reason why they did it is because, like, it's become one entity. You know, they are Al Heyman, they are Golden Boy. You know, so it's not like, I mean, if they were objective and they didn't have vested interests in that and they weren't part of that, you know, association, and they needed those guys to provide them with fighters and fights, no, they would never put on these fights. But I guess, I mean, this is just the most obvious piece that, of course, you know, Stephen Espinoza, the former Golden Boy attorney, was installed at Showtime because of his relationship with Golden Boy, and he's obviously beholden to them to put on slop like this. And, I mean, he can justify it by saying, well, we've had good fights before, you know, we have to do a bad one here and there to get the good ones, but yeah, the good ones haven't been that good. You know, I mean, if you're talking about, like, Garcia, you know, Malinaji, Zab Judah, or Judah Garcia, or, you know, the upcoming, you know, Garcia Lamont Peterson, I mean, I'm not that impressed by this. The one great thing they did was, like, they had the Mayweather-Canelo blockbuster pay-per-view, and they put a really great fight on the undercard with Matisse and Garcia, and that was, you know, they all credit to everyone involved who made that happen, but they don't have that strong of a track record where, in my opinion, where they can just put on something like this and not expect, like, serious, you know, blowback from boxing fans.
Yeah. Hey, did you hear, everybody out there, did you hear that? Not only is Foley not going to get the Golden Boy jobs you guys were going for, that was an impressive rant. I think you really hit that hard.
Well, my anger leading up to calling in has you know, made it even more painful and made me even more angry about the Showtime thing.
Yeah, our jobs are gone. But that said, I totally pretty much agree with just about everything you said, really. I mean, at the end of the day, we're getting a product we don't want. We're getting a product we don't want. That's really what it comes down to. And there are so few other aspects of business where that actually happens and it's okay. It just doesn't happen. You know, when people get a product that they don't want, they don't fucking take it. But we do, so it keeps happening. And it's a pain in the ass.
Let me raise this Heyman question to the next level. He had a run of doing this with HBO, you know, with all those Andre Berto matchups, and people got so upset. And, you know, it eventually led to his departure from HBO. Now, you could say his departure was because Floyd left, and then that led to the other guys leaving, and then it just became, well, Heyman fighters are no longer welcome on HBO. So is this Heyman doing the same thing to Showtime that he did at HBO, or is this just a separate thing altogether? Like, what's your take on that? Is this just what Heyman does, do you think?
Go ahead, Foley.
Well, the thing about it is, you know, when Heyman was doing it on HBO, and it was still, we were getting a lot of bad fights, it was largely, you know, like up-and-coming prospects that they were pushing. I mean, Heyman didn't have the stable that he has now. You know, Danny Garcia is supposed to be a champion, you know, the legitimate champion. I mean, he's supposed to be the guy at 140. So it's one thing if you're going to fight, like, you know, once a month or something, and you're taking some soft touches here and there. But when you're fighting twice a year and you're getting paid, you know, almost seven-figure purses, I mean, it just has to be a higher standard than this. And so I have no idea what the angle is, except for the fact that You know, I mean, if Showtime and HBO are the ones who buy these fights, pay these massive license fees, they really are kind of the customer in this situation. And, you know, if the customer is willing to buy crap well above its market value, then you can't blame the guys who are, you know, the merchants for selling it to them. So I just think it's obviously that those relationships are so intertwined that they can't say no. I really don't believe that they can say no to Al Heyman. I mean, I think about it and I'm thinking like, well, what if they do? I mean, what is Heyman going to do? I mean, what other choices does he have? HBO is not going to buy Garcia and Salka. What they could sell it to what? Is ESPN can't pay the kind of license fee that they want? I mean, they put it on pay-per-view. Do you think anybody would buy it? So, again, it just makes no sense to me. Like, well, they had no alternative to make this a viable financial fight without the big purse, you know, or the big, like, license fee from Showtime. So, obviously, it's Showtime and Al Heyman and Golden Boy, it's just, they're all the same right now.
And
they really shouldn't be when you think about it.
I think the fighters missed the mark. They missed the chance to put a little bit of a Band-Aid on the whole feeling by coming out after each fight and saying, yeah, I want Peterson. Yeah, I want Garcia. No matter what it takes, let's do this. You saw how good he was tonight. I want him. You know, I mean, even if that was completely staged and fake, they missed the chance to win back some of the goodwill of the fans, whether it be the fighters or somebody from Golden Boy or somebody coming on the microphone and saying, look at who you saw tonight. You saw two of the best junior welterweights in the world, and you're probably going to see them again next time. Instead, it was that, yeah, I'm not really sure of the script right now. I'm not sure where we're going, so it's up to my manager. And, man, that has to make you mad.
Well, that's for sure, but, you know, even if they had, I mean, who cares? But, like, I'm going to go to my friends and be like, hey, you hear who Danny Garcia is fighting next? Lamont Peterson.
Right, the educated fans would say, who cares? There's no doubt about it. This match isn't all it was built up to be. But at least that says to everyone who's skeptical, this is why we did this card. Dead, you don't know why.
Yeah, I mean, I guess. Yeah, I mean, I hear you. I mean, that too is troubling. I mean, I just hate that, like, fighters now won't call out opponents. I love the guys who do it. You know, I love Golovkin said names, Kovalev. I love those guys. But these guys who are just hiding, like, well, you know, it's up to my manager. I mean, it even annoys me. You know, I'm a huge Pacquiao fan, and it annoys me when he does it too, whatever Bob Arum wants. You know, I mean, it's just like, just call out a name. I mean, if Pacquiao had been more vocal, more aggressive about Mayweather in some of the post-fight interviews, it probably still doesn't happen. But, you know, maybe it does push more people to be like, yeah, let's make that happen. But, you know, you just are so...
I literally think it happens. I literally think you're right, that if Manny had a completely different personality and he had been constantly pushing, that it would have happened, because you have to keep your number one guy happy.
Well, to directly respond to what Foley was asking, part of the whole rumor or whatever behind the Golden Boy split or whatever you want to call it that recently happened was that Al Heyman could potentially branch out on his own and try to, you know, create some type of, I don't know, maybe boxing channel or independent pay-per-view type of thing. That was part of the rumor, and that was something that, Hauser had...
But I would just be, if I were HBO or Showtime, I'd say, okay, good luck with that. I mean, Heyman doesn't have that many guys. I mean, we've seen the kind of matchmaking he's doing,
was,
you know, I mean, what, like, what
yeah,
are they,
no, what
HBO
I was,
and Showtime
what
are the only games
was
in town.
That, but what I was going to say was that if you even look at, like, the kind of independent promotion or independent pay-per-views that, like, Top Rank has done, you know, and by independent, I mean independent of HBO, which, you know, for example, like the Pinoy Power type of pay-per-views that they did for a while. When you do those type of pay-per-views, the problem is that you're then forced to see what the actual market value of your fighter is. And so you get to see that, for example, Nonito Donaire is not selling shit on these Pinoy Power pay-per-views, and you need to try, you know, whatever. You know, and so in any event, I highly doubt that's the case. But then to go towards what Brian had brought up as far as, like, what's going on here and why was this allowed, I definitely take the cynic approach that there's no way that Al Heyman is doing this for the betterment of the sport. There's no way that Al Heyman just kind of volunteered to be like, hey, Showtime, look, guys, you guys are falling behind, okay? You've never been ahead of HBO. You know what, dude, I just feel bad for you. I'm just going to volunteer my fucking services and my stable of fighters to better you guys as a network because I want you to beat HBO. I mean, maybe there's some type of spite or something involved because of the split with HBO or the ban on HBO. That's possible. But if I'm going to be looking at that, I'm sure that there's some, you know, Al Heyman is not doing this out of the goodness of his heart is what I'm saying. I'm sure he's being, you know, well compensated, making plenty of money. So all around, basically, I think this is pretty much an in-your-face hoodwink. We buy it, and we get taken advantage of because we will, and there's not really anything right now to stop us from doing it. So, or, you know, rather than buying, tuning in, I should say, regardless. Yeah, I don't know.
I think you're right. I think you're 100% right. It plays to what we talked about earlier about the hardcore fan is always going to buy it, so maybe this is that attempt to sort of reach out to the casual fan and not care about the hardcore fan. And that's frustrating. Frustrating as all heck.
Yeah. Well, like James had said, this entire card put together was basically one big mismatch. So I guess I'll just quickly go to the last one, which was Danny Jacobs versus Jared Fletcher. But going in, that seemed to be the kind of almost the saving grace of this card to a lot of people. Many felt that Jared Fletcher was actually coming in with experience, might be able to pull something off, do something. That very clearly was not the case. Was this kind of just a miscalculation on the part of people who thought Jared Fletcher might, you know, with all due respect, not suck? Or was this kind of a miscalculation in that, you know, maybe Danny Jacobs is coming along farther? Or what do you think, Brian Campbell?
I think it came out that Fletcher really wasn't as good as not that everyone really thought, but, I mean, there was sort of some people who were starting to get, well, if Triple G had to fight him just to stay busy, whatever, and you would have had a demolition right there. I think partially you are right that I think Danny Jacobs is improving on thought. For the most part, he did look good. I mean, he looked fantastic in that first round where he put together power punches. It was a lot like how he looked against Fernando Guerrero, and I really liked – after he sort of slowed down and didn't look as good but still controlled the next few rounds, how he bounced back in that fifth round. When it was the first round where Fletcher was starting to show life, he landed about four flush right hands in a row during the certain sequence, and that was what forced Jacobs to sort of almost come out with a mean streak. It was the same mean streak he came out with in that Guerrero fight when he had the knockout, when he kind of got pinned against the ropes and out of nowhere he just spun back and really just came on with some of his hardest punches of the fight. He did that against Fletcher. You know, it didn't make me think, wow, this guy's going to take down Golovkin or anything like that, but it made me think, you know, he might be a decent player at 160. I mean, the problem with this whole storyline is that it's a crap title, that, you know, he gets to be the first cancer survivor to win a world title, and it's a great story, and, man, he is a great human being. I've loved following his rise coming back from this. Great guy to talk to and all that. But when you really look at the situation with that belt and how there's three title belts at 160 for the WBA and how, man, it's just a joke. It's just it almost ruined that whole fight. It almost ruined that whole story, and it almost became another negative to the whole card. Am I just too angry?
No, you're right. You're right. And the thing is, like, let's just say hypothetically, you know, if Jacobs did the impossible or the unthinkable and actually – well, actually, of course, now Cotto is the lineal champion, so what am I talking about? I was going to say if Jacobs beat Golovkin to become the real champ, but that wouldn't, you know. So whatever, if Jacobs became the lineal champ at some point, of course, that would be a real significant achievement and a great, even greater story, but it wouldn't get as much play because a lot of people, casual fans, whoever, would just be, well, I thought he already did that 2 years, you know, I thought he'd already won a championship or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, it totally diminishes it, that we all know that it was... you know, basically the easiest possible way to get a belt. I mean, I don't think Fletcher's really even a top 20 contender at middleweight. Obviously should not have been fighting for any kind of a title. And, you know, I mean, as far as, like, people were saying that this could be, you know, people were basically saying, hey, like, the main event's a 70-1 favorite, and, Lamont Peterson was, like, a 20-1 favorite, and, you know, so Jacobs was, like, a 10-1 favorite. So it was like, oh, it looks like a great, you know, most evenly matched fight on the card. I mean, it didn't mean a whole lot. You know, like, Fletcher had been – didn't he get knocked out by Billy Joe Saunders in two rounds a couple years ago?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, there was nothing to really suggest. I mean, we know Jacobs is talented. He's a good fighter. He will be he's probably a top 10 guy at middleweight. I mean, the Parag fight, you know, he was a rising, you know, real contender that people were looking at as potentially being, you know, one of the best fighters until that Parag fight a couple years ago. So –
we know he has talent, and we assume that he's better. He can beat a guy like Fletcher, you know. And I mean, respect to Fletcher. I don't like to see these underdogs come in and get like humiliated because it, you know, I don't. It doesn't reflect poorly on them in my mind. It's just that they really shouldn't have been, you know, been in the ring with these guys.
It just stinks that if you're a casual fan and you're watching and you have no idea, you probably think, based on the way it's announced by the ring announcer, that Danny Jacobs is the middleweight champion of the world. And when you package that with the fact that Jermaine Taylor could win a belt pretty soon, it's like, damn, boxing, you're killing me.
Well, I was just going to say, not only is it like he's not even like the real middleweight champion, he's not even the real WBA champion.
That's it.
Well, I mean, you know, I brought it up a couple weeks ago. Like, it might even have been last. I don't know. I don't even know what happened 5 minutes ago. The point is that I had brought it up previously that, you know, I was trying not to be mean when I said it or sound like a real asshole. But the point was that I was, you know, bringing up the kind of, I don't know, cancer storyline as not a negative, but just something that's really been pushed. And it kind of ties into how you opened this whole thing, Brian, that it just feels kind of gimmicky. And I really feel bad for the guy. The story itself is very easy to root for, like makes him very easy to root for in general. But bringing the title into it and trying to then create this, you know, just this kind of story arc, that it almost, like, I don't know, that's just something I wouldn't ever have even thought about, like, to like, keep track of. Like, and I keep track of a lot of, like, random history tidbit type of shit. And if somebody just came up to me and was just like, hey, who's the first cancer survivor to win a title? I'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? What? I just wouldn't even have thought about it. And so for that to now enter the equation, I was just kind of like, why? What? Why? Come on. Just say he won a belt. Just say that it was some kind of, like, you know, whatever belt that he won against Jared Fletcher. Move on.
But, you know, if it goes back to our original point where this card wasn't for the hardcore fan and it wasn't cared if the hardcore fan would tune in because they knew the hardcore fan would tune in, and this was only for the casual fan to pick up on some new guys to get behind, then if it leads to creating Jacobs as a character and a potential fighter for them because they have Peter Quillen, who's been essentially on an island for a while and this without a real opponent, and this leads to them fighting in the next fight in the Barclays Center, it's not bad. So that's sort of a situation where you're like, all right, you know, this is going in a decent direction. At least Jacobs would take this fake title and go in against a real titleist and a guy who we really want to see against somebody with a pulse and somebody who might be good. Then I hope we're going there because, you know, of course, Jacobs called it out afterwards that he wants to fight Quillen. Quillen instantly tweeted that he'd love to do it. Now you just hope that that's part of Al's plan.
Yeah. Man. And to have to kind of, like, you know, add that asterisk onto everything. Let's just hope that falls in line with what, you know, everything, whatever.
Well, you're not going to get an interview with him, right? You're not going to get – you can't text him. Like, hold on. Let me text Al. I'll get right back to you. I'll get
to
the bottom.
Well, you're not going to text him. You can't text him. I mean, you're – whatever, dude. Text him, dude.
No, I was going to say, Brian, that was – that even bringing up Al Heyman on Friday Night Fights the other night, that was probably like the most extensive conversation about Al Heyman I've heard on any kind of boxing program.
It's just,
and again, of course, you still really couldn't say a whole lot because no one has ever spoken to him or knows what his real angle is.
It's not like it's not like I and everybody else want to paint this guy as some villain or some mysterious dude. Like, that's not the angle. That's not, like, he doesn't have to be boxing's bad guy. I don't even know if he's boxing's bad guy because we just don't know.
I don't blame him for anything that he does because his job is not to make great fights. His job is to get his clients paid a lot of money. You know,
right.
it's the powers that be that enable that. And somebody like Showtime, who should be just this objective, you know, I mean, they really are, as a broadcaster of fights, they should have more of a journalistic approach than, you know, you know what I mean? It's not like, they're not like the UFC or something where they should just,
right,
you know, put like promoting every event that they put on. I mean, this is like they should have an objective view toward this, but unrealistic to think that.
I'm sorry to cut you. You illuminated a great point right there. That even 2 years ago, HBO and Showtime were, you know, when the Cold War wasn't as cut and dry and officially on the billboards of you can't fight here and you can't fight here, when anybody could fight anywhere, you're right. They were journalistic bodies. That's when a show like The Fight Game with Jim Lampley would have thrived a lot more, when you really could sort of recap the whole boxing world, because, you know, who actually had a contract with, you know, one of the two networks that could keep somebody from jumping back and forth? It was, you know, one or two guys. It was very few. You're right. Now, when you sort of said at the beginning of the show that they're one thing, it's Al, it's the promoter, and it's the network, and they are really one thing, you're right. It really is at that point. So it sort of diluted what guys like Max Kellerman used to be so great at, which was really, you know, summing up what's going on in the world. Now you can't get these guys to really give you the fair takes on the broadcast, and it's really hurt the sport and added another level of callous to really what this Cold War has done to the sport.
Yeah, and Brian Kenny used to be a great guy at that, because he respected, you know, at the time when Ring Magazine had a little bit more legitimacy or the, you know, more objectivity. He really vouched, you know, he was huge on the Ring Magazine rankings, and he wouldn't recognize the titles as being real champions when he used to be at ESPN. And you just see the attitude completely change, and now it's kind of like they're trying to sell you a product, you know. And even when they acknowledged at the beginning of the show, hey, you know, these fights might not be that competitive or whatever, it was kind of in the sense of like, but we're setting up something good. But, you know, what is that? I mean, and again, it's like the one thing that the UFC does right is their rankings are so cut and dry. And, you know, generally speaking, I mean, you have the champion is always facing one of those top contenders. And a fight like you said, Brian, like, yeah, Quillen and Jacobs is a good fight. And you said Quillen's a real titleist. And, yeah, I guess that's kind of true. But, you know, he's not the real champion. And so if this were UFC, this would be a fight between, like, the number 3 and the number 7 contender or something, and it would be on an undercard somewhere. You know, and this is what stands today for a championship-level main event on a premium network. It's just people wonder, you know, I mean, I think this is a bigger issue than people realize as far as boxing's lack of popularity. You know, on top of so many other things that you can't control, like people's, you know, aversion to violence and that kind of stuff, the one thing you could, you know, the sport could control is at least, you know, having competitive fights and getting the best guys into championships and so forth.
Well, I think that actually you bringing up the UFC thing is pretty important, in the sense that, like, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but it was probably about 3 years ago, Oscar De La Hoya had, I mean, of course, right off the bat, you're going to be like, take it with a grain of salt, dude. But Oscar De La Hoya did an interview where he had basically said that he wanted Golden Boy Promotions to pretty much take over the sport of boxing and become more like the UFC. And I actually wrote an article about that for when the Boxing Bulletin was still around, and when I was just kind of writing articles now and again. But basically, he had said something along those lines where he had wanted to be able to consolidate a lot of things so that there was more control and he could make, I don't really know, he probably wanted to just make more money, but he said he wanted to make champions fight each other and blah, blah, blah. So, in any event, that was actually right before this thing really started kind of unfolding and boxing fans really got to see what was, you know, being set up, more or less, between this whole, you know, Showtime versus HBO versus whomever thing. In any event, I thought it was kind of interesting that you brought it up, because that actually seemed to kind of have maybe a small role in it.
I think that was Golden Boy's attention. And here's, like, you made a good point on the whole UFC thing. And the reason why the UFC, their game plan and their model is so brilliant is because they were able to take a sport that was dead and literally unable to, you know, get on pay-per-view anymore and build it back up the right way, where they had complete control over everything. So every time, you know, boxing fans are like, man, I wish this was more like the UFC in that regard, boxing would have to, you know, either one entity would have to be so big where it took over complete control, or the sport would really have to hit the ultimate rock bottom to get there. And that's when Heyman started to make this some of his strides and sign so many fighters in the last year, I have been, and I still somewhat am hesitant, like we said, to sort of label this as a bad thing, because if it comes to a point where he simply represents everybody, then maybe you do get a situation where it's a little bit more like a UFC setup, because that's what boxing fans have longed for a long time, is somebody to have ultimate control. And I don't mean that with like a dictator standing at the top. I mean even just like a centralized governing body. It's this Wild West thing that kills it in a lot of ways. And I don't know, though, if we could ever really get there. I doubt it.
So, hey,
yeah,
real
it,
quick before
track
anybody...
Record, it's not, you know, you don't, he doesn't just doesn't seem to want to operate that way. Of course, a big reason why is because oftentimes fighters who are more popular and can bring in more money aren't necessarily the best fighters. And so, therefore, it's like, it doesn't make sense to risk having them take the toughest fights because, when fighters lose, that oftentimes affects their popularity and that kind of thing.
Well, before we get too far, sorry to interrupt, but I know that you're going to be having to step away pretty soon, Brian. Before
that
you
is.
Go, I wanted to get your perspective, if you would, on this this weekend's Sean Porter versus Kell Brook matchup.
Yeah, dude. This fight, and I put that on Twitter today, it came out of nowhere for me. It was almost as if I forgot that it was coming up this weekend, and maybe that's because of all this Garcia-Salca thing that we've been talking about for months now. But this is a really good fight, and I was going back. I was writing the five keys for each fighter that I sometimes do for ESPN.com, and I was going back and rewatching some of the Kell Brook fights, and I just really started to kind of wake up that we have a really good matchup here of two unbeaten welterweights who really want to be next. And I and I'm favoring Porter in this spot. I think he's really evolved in his past few fights to really commit to this aggressive, raw, bulldozing style where he just gets in your grill and just makes it very difficult for you to breathe. You know, he's leading with his head. He's winging hooks in there. He's going to the body hard. He is a tough out, and that's why I was very quick after both of his last two fights to sort of go, man, why aren't we talking about this guy with Mayweather? Because this is a very interesting style matchup because he has that style that is really hard to sort of corral. And you mix that with a guy in Kell Brook who I never really have given the benefit of the doubt because he just hasn't beaten anybody on the level that really makes you go, okay, that guy's for real. But what you do see when you watch the film is a very polished, well-rounded boxer puncher who can do a lot of different things. So I think what it comes down to is Kell Brook has to do everything in his power to not get overwhelmed. He really has to, whether it's by establishing that jab or catching Porter coming in with that right uppercut that he likes to throw or whatever it is, he's going to have a long night, I think, if he doesn't really gain that respect early and be able to turn this into more of a boxing match than a slugfest, which Devin Alexander was really never able to do. You know, a couple times it looked like he was getting back on track, but really never able to do it. And obviously, Paulie was swallowed up by that. I favor Porter in this, and I think there's potential to be some action because I think Kell Brook is going to be put in certain situations that he hasn't been before. I mean, we saw him maybe against Carson Jones where he really had to be challenged, but this is another level.
I tend to agree, but I also wanted to say real quick that you ought to think about letting Oscar De La Hoya know that the five keys for the fighters isn't what he thinks.
Wow.
Just saying, dude.
Loved it.
Just saying. No, I really do agree, though. And I actually wish that there were more American – I don't know how I'm even deadpanning this shit right now, but I wish that there were more American fans that knew a little bit more about Kell Brook because he's a pretty decent fighter. And, you know, I think that said, that's a big reason why Sean Porter is being pushed a little bit and being favored so much going in here. Not that, you know, I've kind of spoken down a little bit on Porter in the recent past, but – I do have to agree that his showing against Devin Alexander was impressive, and then, you know, he kind of rebounded a little bit against Julio Diaz despite having a bad showing in that first fight. So, in any event, well, of course, smashing Paulie Malignaggi, it was, I don't know, I mean, no offense to Paulie, it was just kind of funny. In any event, yeah, I agree, and I think that this is a pretty competitive, kind of interesting fight going in. Yeah. I just don't want to spill forth too much because I know you're going to have to head out pretty soon. I don't want to get you caught like in one of my rambling sessions.
I do have to pull the plug like Million Dollar Baby. Oh man, do we really have to go back?
Damn.
That's your
that
favorite boxing movie of all time, right?
Oh man, that's the worst takes us back
Clint Eastwood, to Clint Eastwood.
No. Yeah. Man.
It's horrible. Yeah, I know.
Hey, I got one more question for you guys. One final question. How many special people change? How many? I heard that on the radio, man, today. I was just going all old school 90s throwback today. Just had a little bit of that.
Oh, man, dude.
I mean,
where
were you? Where were you while we were getting high? That's really the question I want to know. You know?
I was in I don't know about you guys. I was in a champagne supernova.
Yeah. All right, enough of this, guys. Great times. Great oldies. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for coming,
Ryan,
dude. You're
thanks,
always, always a hoot.
Appreciate it, guys. Have a great show.
All right, man. Take it easy. That was the Brian Campbell, Oh,
one,
man.
Truly one of
legend.
The nicest guys in the sport, you know. Like a lot of boxing writers and fans are just cynical bastards, and Campbell is, of course, able to appreciate that side of it, but he's just such a gentleman about it.
And on top of that, you know, he's just one of the types of guys. Of course, this is that part where, like, the guy, like the guest just left, and we've fawned all over him for about 90 seconds. But he really is one of those types of guys that, you know, he's good at what he does. He knows a lot about boxing. He's a nice dude. But if you just kind of talk to him, you wouldn't really think that he's, you know, anything other than you're just your average dude. But he's not. He's a good guy. So thanks to him for coming on, because that guy's legit now. He's big time.
No, he doesn't take the ESPN platform and act like a big swinging dick about it. He's very totally down to earth. Always been really supportive of us and the show. So
yeah.
Gotta give him
good dude.
Give him massive props. As a human being.
Yep.
Patrick, he's a credit to his race, the human race.
You know, sometimes it's just like you get one boxing podcast guest that comes from a rice paddy. And one comes from the streets of... Wait, no. Fuck, I fucked that up. Oh, man. Now, he's a good dude. And just kind of continuing on with what we were talking about, what do you think
about
this?
Yeah, man. Sorry I was so wound up when I fucking called in. I probably should have just calmed down for a little bit because I had, like, just...
No, that was good.
Back from
that was
from
good
work,
shit.
But, nah, not even.
That was unleashing you on the fucking world, dude. That was great. So yeah,
I felt like a dick because the mood was like so mellow when I jumped in, and then I felt like Teddy Atlas over here. Against who?
Actually, Campbell did a little Teddy Atlas impression before you jumped on, because we were talking about Francisco Rodriguez versus Takayama. Yeah, he gave a wow right at the beginning of his thought. It was awesome.
That's awesome. And, dude, by the way, obviously in typical fashion, I have not seen the fight yet. I know it's fight of the year candidate, front runner. I have it on my list. I got to watch it. I just haven't had enough time to watch it. I made time to watch the Showtime card, of course, which is brilliant.
Of course.
But actually, I watched that like late Saturday night. I recorded it, and I didn't know. What was that Rodriguez fight on TV? I screwed up by not recording it.
It was
Telemundo or something?
It was on some like odd network I didn't even know I had that was called like BEIN or something like that.
Oh, I got
it was
that.
Actually on
yeah,
it was on in HD, and I didn't even know. I don't know. I don't really scroll down that
nice.
Far. I have like, you know, I have like a core set of channels that I give a shit about, and I just didn't even know about that. So but yeah, I actually wound up catching it. Like I caught it like just as it was starting, and I was like, "Oh, holy shit, I actually have it."
Oh, you watched
it
live?
Good. Yeah.
Oh, dude, that's like true boxing head.
Well, honestly,
yeah,
it was Twitter. I got clued in by Twitter.
No,
I
would have,
so
too,
I
if I would have been around, man. I actually watched like all that stuff on Friday night, and like, I would have, too, you know. But,
well, I had to go find
I have
it,
the YouTube. I have the YouTube link, so I'm ready to – I'm going to fire that up at some point.
Do that shit. Well, in any event,
well, I mean, I can't vote for my BWA. I can't vote for Fight of the Year, you know, without having seen it.
Well, dude, you know what? No, I'm not even going to tell that joke. Never mind. I'm not going to go there. So, yeah, I was going to say something about the, you know, International Boxing Hall of Fame votes and who has those, but regardless. Sean Porter versus Kell Brook. James Foley. What do you think?
It's a really good fight. I mean, especially in comparison to what just preceded it, you know, but it's a good fight. I haven't been particularly impressed with Brooks and with the fights that I've seen, the Carson Jones fights. I'm trying to remember his last couple fights. I think I've probably seen him 4 or 5 times. And he just seems to me to be somewhat limited, a good fighter. I think he's really going to need to raise his game to something that we've never seen to beat Porter. I've just been, like everyone else, really impressed with Porter the last couple fights. And I think that we can, you know, undeniably say that Porter will be by far Kell Brook's best opponent. I don't know if we can say that about the other way around. I mean, I do think that Porter beating, you know, Devin Alexander was more accomplished than Brook. Malignaggi, that's kind of debatable. But, you know, I do think the Alexander fight was a big win for him. Alexander, you know, he's looked not great at times, but he has been in against the best fighters at 140 and guys at 147. I mean, he, you know, beat Maidana, probably the better, you know, the most one-sided loss that Maidana has. So Alexander's a good fighter, and that really impressed me that Porter came out and was so aggressive and really took that fight to him and beat him up and managed the impossible, made Devin Alexander entertaining. So, I really like Porter. I agree with what Campbell said. I mean, I look at Porter, and I think that's a great candidate to fight Floyd Mayweather someday. I think he has a really good personality, too. He's very, like, well-spoken. He seems kind of pensive. And I think, in my mind, Porter, Keith Thurman, that would be a great, great fight. And the winner of that, I think, would be really poised to get into the Mayweather sweepstakes. So for me, this fight does have a clear favorite. I don't think it's really a 50-50 fight. I think Porter's a strong favorite based on styles, how good they've looked, and who they've fought. But that said, you know, anytime you have a guy like Kell Brook, he's got his head with 30 pro fights or something, and aside from the first Jones fight, he's never lost, so he's got a lot at stake. You know, and in that sense, you know, it is a really good matchup. And again, compared to most of the crap that we've been seeing, it's a great fight.
Yeah, and you know, I think that there's a pretty decent chance. I think there's a pretty decent chance that the style matchup between them will actually produce a competitive fight. And I kind of agree with what Campbell was saying about Kell Brook being able to actually use distance. He's got a pretty good jab. And, you know, there's a possibility that he can do that, although I do also kind of agree with what you're saying. If, you know, and correct me if I'm wrong, it basically sounds like you're saying that Brook is probably on a slightly different tier than Sean Porter. And if that's what you're saying, I would agree. I think that that's probably
that's what I believe.
The case. I think that's probably going to wind up playing out that way. But I am kind of skeptical of the Sean Porter thing, and I brought this up on a guy that actually has been, you know, tweeting along with our show, you know, fairly regularly and responds and stuff like that, and actually has his own podcast that I talked briefly about Porter Brook with. His name is Martin, TKO Radio on Twitter, in any event. Point is, yeah, good dude. But we talked about it, and I think that the U.S. audience not knowing Kell Brook is also contributing to the whole favorite thing, like I said earlier. But I totally lost my train of thought of what I was saying earlier. Jesus Christ. In any event, going into the fight, I think that there's a really good chance that Porter's just going to be too much. He's going to overwhelm. He's probably just going to be a little bit much, even though I'm a little bit skeptical. That's where I was going. Skeptical of the performances and skeptical of the opposition. And I was going to say not the PED stuff,
and
because
skeptical
that's
of
where...
the association with Victor Conti. Oh, no, you weren't going there.
Well, I wasn't, but you fucking opened the
no,
game.
No.
But...
I mean, we probably shouldn't. But,
well, I was
you know,
just
like,
going to mention
I just
it. I was
like
going to mention
who they fought. I mean, I simply look at who they fought. If Kell Brook had wins over Malignaggi and Devin Alexander, I would be favoring him, you know, and if he looked as explosive as Porter did. I mean, it has nothing to do with I know there are a lot of British boxing fans, which is awesome. I think it's great that the sport is so popular over there. I mean, even casual sports fans over there have much more knowledge of boxing than just casual American sports fans. But I do think they have a tendency to become, like, very defensive about fighters and think that we're downgrading them, like, just because they're British. And that's not the case, you know. I mean, it's some people probably, but that's not what I'm doing. I mean, I just look at who they fought, and I think Porter's looked better and fought better opposition. So, it's pretty easy pick.
Yeah, and I think that there's room to, you know, pick that way or lean that way like we are. But I think that there's room to pick that way, but also still be skeptical of Sean Porter's opposition. Like, you know, I used to rail on Devin Alexander before, even though I thought that he was going to beat Sean Porter. But, you know, I was kind of unkind to him, Paul Malignaggi, blah, blah, blah. I think that there's a very good chance that if Sean Porter stepped in with somebody that was, you know, a really upper-tier welterweight, he would probably lose. But regardless, this matchup here could say a lot about where Sean Porter is. Because, you know, Kell Brook, he might maybe not quite be on the exact same level or tier or whatever, but depending on how Sean Porter handles this, that could say a lot about where his next step is going to be. And I do agree with you also about the personality thing, because he's not your typical, I don't know, just kind of meathead type of guy. He seems like a nice kid. He seems like a pretty well-spoken dude. And he seems like a guy who, you know, understands where he is and what he is and where he needs to go, blah, blah, blah. So I think that he could potentially in the future, if he, you know, puts together a few more really good wins, be considered an opponent for Floyd Mayweather.
Yeah. I mean, I like his personality a lot. And, you know, the thing is, like, if he beats Brook, it's another really good win. You know, it doesn't, to me, vault him into, I mean, you still have Mayweather, Pacquiao, Tim Bradley, you know, you got another undefeated guy, Keith Thurman, who hasn't really fought anybody, but I think still ranks a little bit ahead of Brook in terms of probably ability and talent. So, you know, there's other fighters that I think another, you know, big winner too. You know, one of the things I hate most about the Cold War is that Tim Bradley's not there for some of these Golden Boy guys to fight. I think Tim Bradley would be a great, great fight for, you know, Porter or Keith Thurman, and that would really tell us, you know, where he is, because we could compare it against, you know, Pacquiao and Marquez, who have fought Bradley. So the problem here is just that Brooks had such limited opposition that, I don't even know. I think it's fair to still have doubts about Porter, even if he, you know, blows Brook out. And that's just because there's such a gap between, you know, the guys at the top and then that kind of next level of up-and-comers. But, you know, between the two, I think Alexander is probably the biggest win, not just in terms of, you know, name or whatever, but also the way that he did it. Because Alexander, he is a capable enough boxer, and he is a guy who can, you know, beat some top guys and at least hang in on even terms against top guys. And you know, that to me was a pretty big moment. You know, Paul Malignaggi, I mean, yeah, you have to take it with a grain of salt. Malignaggi is a good boxer. He's obviously a little older, and he's also... You know, I mean, Porter's a big, fast, powerful guy, and I think that Paulie has kind of been beaten up before, and that, you know, he's an older fighter now and a little bit slower, and that in retrospect, it probably was never really going to be a competitive fight. But Porter's still a guy that, you know, he still has upside. I mean, I think he's somebody we can look at and say he could really get better. You know, he could get better. I mean, he's at that top tier of guys right below the top level. But with potential to get there at some point.
Yeah, and you do bring up a good point in that just because he's not good enough for that, you know, last tier at welterweight doesn't mean he's not good. And so I probably have kind of undersold him a little bit. And, you know, I do kind of wonder if he's getting overrated going into this just because of the factor of the unknown thing. But regardless, I think that that's a good point. And I think that... You know, 147 pounds is a weird division in that regard, in that it seems kind of stacked, but then once you start kind of making the matchups in your mind, you're kind of like, oh, I don't want to see that guy against that guy. Oh, no, he's too good for that guy, you know. So, I don't know. We kind of have to see how this type of stuff plays out. But if Sean Porter is going to be going forward and, you know, expecting those types of fights, those big types of fights, then I think he's got to pretty much clean up this weekend.
just keep winning and keep looking good. And I think a fight like, I mean, I really hope that they do try to go with the Keith Thurman direction, but who knows if they will. They might, you know, maybe they want to have each guy fight Mayweather separately or something. But, you know, Mayweather's getting older too, and his fight with Maidana was more competitive than we expected. I don't think he's going to continue to be as dominant as he is. I mean, I think it may suit Mayweather to look for another mega fight next year, and that's not going to be against one of these unknown welterweight guys. So, you know, assuming the Pacquiao thing doesn't happen, he may look back at Canelo or Cotto or someone like that. And, you know, neither Porter nor Thurman may end up ever getting a shot at Floyd, just because that's not the way that, you know, it'll play out. But who knows? You know, they're both really exciting guys to watch, and they're both really easy to root for, good personalities. I just wish that, you know, to me, it's like, I don't think any of those guys will ever really have a mandate to fight Mayweather. Just like I think Pacquiao is running out of opponents that, you know, he's already beaten Bradley. Marquez, that'll always be there, but Marquez, there's so many question marks. Does he want to continue? Does he want a fifth fight? Doesn't really sound like it. I mean, Pac's fighting Chris Algieri. It's marginally better, you know, than, well, whatever, you know. So it's just, I don't know, man. It'll be interesting to see how things play out over the next, like, couple years, and those are definitely, like, two guys to keep an eye on.
Porter, your boy Chris A? Oh, your boy Chris A, I thought you meant.
No, I mean, I just meant, like, you know.
It's just too bad.
I mean, I love a Bradley Provodnikov rematch, but man, like, I'd really love to see Bradley fight a couple of those Golden Boys. I'd love to see Bradley fight Danny Garcia at 147. I think Bradley, just by being as competitive as he was with Pacquiao, and in my mind, still losing both fights pretty clearly, but, you know, by beating Marquez, I think Bradley really established himself as, like, the next best guy behind Mayweather and Pacquiao. So I think he's a perfect litmus test, and he's never been really blown out, although I did think Pacquiao boxed him fairly handily. So to see somebody, you know, make a statement against Bradley would be great. You know, it's just boxing, there's always going to be so many question marks. I mean, even if Porter and Thurman fought each other, it's like the winner of that fight, well, people will diminish the loser and say, well, he never really fought anybody. I mean, Keith Thurman still hasn't really fought anybody that good. You know,
well,
so let's just say Porter and Thurman fought and Porter beat Thurman. How good of a win is it? You know, it's tough to say.
Yeah, and I think that they're probably also reluctant to, you know, potentially harm or waste the momentum of either Porter or Thurman by matching them against each other as much as we'd like that fight. I mean, I'd love that fight, but, yeah, the idea of kind of, you know, ruining one or both potentially in that fight is kind of rough. You know, most promoters probably aren't going to want to do that. But I think that bringing up Bradley is pretty much perfect. And it's actually what one of the guys who's, I think, listening in and definitely tweeting along, and I don't know if it's his real name or just his Twitter name, but Mickey Landsman, a.k.a., you know, at Mickey Chicago, he had brought up.
I'm pretty sure that's
putting,
a character from The Wire.
Is
I think.
It? I don't know. See, that's one of those shows that I never watched that's, like, on my list that I'm trying to get to, The Wire. And I know that that's a sin because I know everybody always says that shit was so great. But give me time, I'll watch it. But regardless, he had brought up the idea of putting Bradley in the mix, too. And I think that that's what's really fucked up about this shit is that Bradley's the perfect guy to throw in that mix of, you know, the Golden Boy fighters that would be just, you know, not only a litmus test, but, you know, potentially beat some of them, of course, but just the potential of matchups in there is, I don't know, Bradley gets a lot of shit.
Yeah, I mean, I think that
he makes up for some pretty good fights.
He's beaten everyone except for Pacquiao, and that includes Marquez, who was coming off the biggest win of his career. You know, Bradley's obviously a really, really good fighter, so that's, you know, you beat Bradley, that it is pretty big validation for whoever can do it.
Yeah, it's pretty big, and so it just sucks that
he can't be, or at least for right now, he can't be or isn't in that mix. But I hope he is soon, because Bradley's the type of dude that I think would do better fighting more often and, you know, I don't know, not fighting Pacquiao, basically.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, that's the problem with you. Once you make it to that level, you get a couple pay-per-views, you're making that kind of money, you know, you're not going to go back to fighting every 3 months or something like that.
Pretty much.
Yeah, well, let's hope that our boy Gennady Golovkin never gets to that point, because I love the idea of him fighting three or four times a year forever, all the way until I'm 83 years old.
I want him to have hopefully it lasts as long as Hopkins, right?
Oh, yeah. Can't wait for it. So on
yeah,
the undercard
the same fighting style.
Oh, fuck me. I hope not. But on the undercard is our boy, Omar Figueroa Jr., against Daniel Estrada. So I actually had to look up Estrada, I'm not going to lie, because I was like, wait a second. For whatever reason, I was confusing him with another Estrada in my mind. I'm like, dude, wait, what? Didn't that guy, like, retire or something? You know, I was thinking David Estrada, and I was like, what? Wait, really? What the hell? And when I looked it up, I was like, oh, okay, all right. And I recognized who it was. And actually, you know, taking kind of like a closer look at this, you know, going, you know, combing through BoxRec and shit, of course, we've seen a fairly decent amount of Figueroa by this point. And they've done some, you know, some kind of, I would have to say, some extra promotion or pushing of his storyline, as it were, on Showtime is kind of like a young hopeful. Especially with that Arakawa fight. So that said, when I actually started looking into this, I was like, you know what, that actually might wind up being a pretty close, competitive, fun fight. Have you, you know, given
yeah,
any thought
I think
to this
same.
Type of
I mean,
shit, man?
I think it could actually be, yeah, I think I agree with you that I think it could turn out to be a really good fight. And I'm not like that familiar with Estrada. But I know he did also fight Arakawa and won pretty wide decision. And he only has a couple, you know, one loss in the last, you know, 8 years or something like that. It was a split decision. So, you know, as vulnerable as Figueroa has looked, I think this looks like it could be a pretty competitive fight. I mean, Figueroa has not looked great in his last, you know, couple outings, but I mean, particularly the Jerry Belmontes fight, and we just saw Jerry Belmontes lose to Abner Cotto, who, you know, Figueroa kind of burst on the scene when he knocked out Cotto in the first round. And since then, well, I mean, he just went life and death with Arakawa. He won almost every round, but it was still a much more brutal competitive fight than people had expected. And then, you know, the Belmontes fight, I thought maybe could have gone either way. So, I don't know. I think Figueroa was somebody I was really excited about like a year or so ago, and maybe the last couple fights kind of, you know, exposed some limitations or made it look like, you know, maybe there was a ceiling there. But at the same time, he's still really young and could conceivably get better. And I think I may have read he had some kind of like hand injury or something. I might be just mixing him up with someone else. But regardless,
he had
I mean,
in
look,
the Eric
it,
Hall fight, I think.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. It's a good. It looks like a good fight, and you know Figueroa, whether he's going to be a, you know, a great pound for pound guy or not, which just looks incredibly doubtful. He's really, really exciting. You know, he throws a lot of punches. He's generally been really exciting. He showed a little bit of power at times. So he's somebody I definitely continue watching. I mean, especially at lightweight, which is a pretty, you know, not the strongest, deepest division right now.
Yeah, and, you know, I thought you brought up a pretty good point with the Belmontes fight, because I actually totally forgot about that he had just fought, what's his name, Cotto, you know, the other, one of the other Cottos, I guess you could say. But, yeah, in kind of hindsight and taking that into consideration, look, I like Omar Figueroa Jr. He's a likable kid, you know, he seems like he's just kind of a happy-go-lucky type of guy. He gets in the ring. He fights hard. You know, he seems like he comes in pretty good shape. He has a decent punch, et cetera, et cetera. But I definitely have the feeling that he's more, I don't know, more Arturo Gatti than, I don't know, throw a fucking other name in there, Floyd Mayweather, I guess. But in the sense that he's exciting and whatnot, but I don't know how far he's actually going to get. And, for instance, the Belmontes fight kind of made me think about that, too, because a lot of folks thought Jerry Belmontes beat Omar Figueroa, like, outright, fair and square, beat him. And then Belmontes goes on to not really look very good against a fighter that's pretty middling, you know, by most standards.
So, right.
And then, you know, of course, like you said, the struggle against Arakawa, when, you know, Arakawa has now gone forward to prove that he's perhaps not that good, You know, he's tough as shit, tough as fucking nails. But as, you know, as far as quality as a fighter, not that good. And Figueroa had a pretty sincere struggle against him. And then, you know, it just all of these factors adding up, he gets hit pretty easily. He's had that hand injury. I don't know if it's a nagging thing. Maybe he's injured it since then, too. I don't know. Regardless, it just makes me think, like, maybe he's a bit more fragile than, you know, he's being sold as. So that said, going in, I don't know a whole shitload about Estrada, but, you know, looking at his record, it seems as though, you know, if he's able to hang with the guys that he's hung with and, you know, beating Arakawa, it seems much more clearly, at least, you know, on paper, than Omar Figueroa did, then, yeah, this could get interesting.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the bottom line is it's better than anything on the card last weekend. So from top to bottom,
yeah.
I mean, this card looks pretty good, and it likely will produce at least one really, you know, good, memorable, competitive fight. And on paper, I mean, this Estrada Figueroa looks like that would be the one.
And, yeah, and going with the kind of larger theme once again, you know, I feel like this is a fight card that we should have been going to and going like, ah, well, you know, at least we had some stronger ones surrounding it. Like, you know, we get a little break, but this is okay, too. Instead, we're looking towards this one like, hell yeah, this is the strong card, you know. It's kind of fucked up.
This is
but,
Mayweather-Canelo in this year.
Yeah, no shit. This is the one or the two or whatever.
The one.
Fuck me. It was horrible. So, I mean, as far as what I was saying with, like, you know, Omar Figueroa, what do you think about that? What do you think about him going forward? Do you think that he's going to be able to really, I don't know, have much of an impact?
I mean, let's take it one fight at a time, you know. I mean, I guess I want to watch on Saturday and kind of see what happens, you know, because three fights ago, he looked awesome. You know, even the war with Arakawa, I mean, on one hand, probably shouldn't have been that competitive, but on the other hand, Arakawa is tough as hell and was coming at him the whole night and has a ridiculous chin and ability to absorb punishment, and Figueroa beat the living shit out of him, you know? And so since then, the only real fight where he struggled was the Belmontes fight. And we had kind of looked at Belmontes and said, well, he's fought some good guys. He's just kind of a tricky style, you know, almost like a Mauricio Herrera to Danny Garcia. Belmonte is looking so flat against Abner Cotto. That might have just been a couple days ago. I think it was on Thursday. It makes the Figueroa fight look a little bit worse, because now it's like, well, you know, Cotto beat Belmonte a lot cleaner than Figueroa did. But it's just hard to say. I mean, it's like boxing. You try to read so much into every single fight, and I don't know. I mean, we'll see what he looks like on Saturday. I mean, he's still one of the most, you know, exciting of the young guys coming up, particularly at lightweight. And I think he can be competitive with a lot of guys in the division. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, based on the Belmontes fight, I wouldn't say that he's going to, you know, be dominating top competition. But I still think that he will be a guy, you know, a factor there. And I think he has a title. And I think because of his style, you know, he's fun to watch. And like you said, he's likable. And he's only 24 years old. So, you know, we always try to just every single fight we're trying to make. So, you know, three fights ago, Sean Porter looked like crap, and we were calling him a poor man's Shane Mosley Jr. You know, so now he's, now, you know, two fights, and he's one of the top, you know, highest regarded welterweights.
Yeah, that's, well, you know what, fucking Foley, I'm a hater by nature, man. God damn it, come on. If these guys don't
respect that. And at times it's just that, like, boxing's not that deep in a lot of these divisions. So,
yeah,
you know, even as flawed and as, you know, average as Figueroa might be, he's still pretty clearly a top 10 lightweight, I would say.
Oh, yeah. Well, and like you said, in a division like that, I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, there's pretty much no question about it. But as you also mentioned, it's not a super deep division. Regardless, as is, you know, taking Omar Figueroa for what he is, he's fun to watch. I'm cool with that. He doesn't have to be, you know, a pound-for-pound player in the future or anything like that. But, you know, it is, you know, kind of fair to start asking the questions that if he's being promoted a certain way, is that in line with reality? You know
Well, you can't believe everything you hear. I mean, I was at the, you know, Andre Fonfara fight, and they were fucking may as well have been talking about, you know, Joe Lewis or, you know, Marvin Hagler or someone like that. I mean, it was like they used not only the greatest light heavyweight in the world, but the greatest, you know. I mean, that's what promoters do. I mean, they hype, you know, that's what they're doing. They're hyping up the product. You know, they can't all be the best fighter. They say it about,
ooh,
like,
Andy?
Enough guy.
Andy Fonfara?
Yeah, Andy Fonfara. Andrew Fonfara.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they proclaimed him, you know, like I would be telling my grandkids one day that I had witnessed this greatness. And I like Fonfara. Fonfara is a good fighter. I'm not, it's nothing against him, nothing against Figueroa, you know. But, look, I mean, that's kind of what promoters do. They want to, especially with young fighters on the way up, because, and it is kind of true that, you know, part of the appeal is that unknown, that, like, we haven't seen the moves yet. We've seen him look shaky, but as long as the guy's still kind of undefeated on the rise, it's like the Deontay Wilder thing. You know, you can always kind of believe that maybe there's some greatness, you know, down the road and, until it gets exposed or whatever. You know, and boxing is the harshest sport that will always, you know, eventually it will be exposed. You know, it separates the wheat from the chaff, right? But, you know, so, yeah, is he everything that you've been told that he is? I mean, I don't know. You know, probably not. There's only one man who will ever live up to all of the hyperbole, and clearly it is Gennadyevich Golovkin.
Yeah, no, there's no question about that. There's absolutely no question about that. Although, you know, Sergey Kovalev, you know, he's up there too. He's up there too, although I do kind of – I'm a little bit more on the Golovkin train than I am on the Kovalev pole.
Yeah. I hear you.
Yeah.
My train goes from Kazakhstan all the way through Siberia, stops by Mama Provodnikov's house, and then heads over to Zhuxining in China. I'm on everything west of basically, like, yeah, Eastern Europe. Everything east of that is whatever fighters emerge from those regions, I'm all in.
Is that the train that stops by Pacquiao's rice paddy that you went to with Larry Merchant?
That's the final destination. Yeah.
Oh, nice. I like it. So
those guys are tough as weeds.
And they're both tough as weeds. Fuck, dude, Larry Merchant. That guy. That's just one of the many, you know, just absolute gems. Needless to say. But speaking of gems. These guys are serious diamonds in the rough here, Saki Obika and Anthony Durrell. You know, these two guys are going to be they're going to be writing epic poems about these guys. They're going to be writing love ballads about these guys. Let's put it that way. So this is a rematch of their first fight, of course. But damn.
Yep.
Damn.
And I remember that fight. Was that on the money team? Was that on one of those Mayweather pay per views?
Now I'm going to have to look it up because I can't even remember, dude.
Might
so,
on the
yeah.
Canelo card, actually.
Well, Saki Obika,
no,
of
wasn't.
Course.
Never mind.
Well, Saki Obika, of course, holds a belt. Yeah, I'll call it. Well, that's what it is. It's a fucking belt. He holds a belt at super middleweight. And, you know, it's just kind of weird to me because I remember in, like, the early 2000s, mid-2000s, Saki Obika was the type of fighter that, for example, like Joe Calzaghe, was like, ah, well, I don't have an opponent. I'm fighting Saki Obika next month. You know? And so for when all of a sudden Saki Obika, like, emerged and, like, he's, like, getting title shots and this and that, I'm like, what the fuck? What happened? Because this guy was basically thought of as kind of just like a stepping stone type of guy. Like, you know, he fights hard and he's crafty and shit and he'll surprise you, but he just wasn't really considered a quality fighter. And then, of course, come to find out, I'm pretty sure he signed with Heyman at some point, and now all of a sudden he's getting these fucking opportunities. I'm sure at some point that, you know, one had to do with the other because he was pretty much out of it for a while, or at least it seemed so. You know, one thing is for sure, dude, quality wife.
I can't remember.
It was
remember
so
wife.
the Look her up. The first Bika Durrell fight was on the undercard of Malinashi Judah, and that was where Sean Porter beat the crap out of Alexander and Arislandi Lada snoozed past Austin Trout. Yeah, that was But in any event,
I looked up Mrs. Bika. He actually has a pretty nice family, so. You know, Bika, he's a really good fighter. He's a good fighter. You know, and has been one of the top guys at, like, 168 for a while now. He basically, you know, has lost to the top three guys and has beaten everyone behind him. And he's good. You know, there's no question. And I can't remember that fight. I remember it was, like, sloppy, and there was, there might have been, like, a knockdown and a point deduction.
Yeah.
But I have almost no memory of that fight. I just remember that it was, like, at times it was good, and then other times, you know, sometimes Bika was imposing himself, and sometimes Durrell was outboxing him. I just can't remember how I scored it or anything. So, I guess it's good that they're doing a rematch, but it's just too bad because like I just can't disassociate Anthony Durrell from his like, in my opinion, much more talented brother Andre, and wondering why Andre's career has gone the way that it has, you know.
Don't even get me started.
So every time Anthony Durrell, I'm just kind of like, what's the point? His brother's better. Like, why isn't he fighting?
And don't even get me started on Andre Durrell. But, I mean, yes, I do. I would have to say that his brother is a little bit quicker, a little bit better schooled, et cetera. And it is, in that sense, you know, kind of a shame, you know, what has happened to his career. But to answer your question, what happened to his career was he had a quote-unquote career-ending brain injury, and then all of a sudden just kind of bounced back and was like, hey, everybody, I'm back. And everyone was like, what the fuck with your career-ending injury? And he was like, no, I'm back. And that was it.
Well, no, do you remember he was on that show, that showbox with Jermaine Taylor?
Yeah.
Against
that was fucking horrible. I think that was Truax.
Yeah, right? Truax. And actually, like, that card looks like, you know, one of the old, like, vintage 80s Don King cards compared to fucking Garcia and Salka. But.
Yeah, that shit was a fucking travesty, but.
You know, it's just like Andre, like, I mean, I don't really, like, I wasn't a huge fan of his style in, like, let's say, like, the Carl Froch fight or whatever, but, I mean, there's times when, like, Andre was really impressive and just had, like, seemingly had all the tools, you know, and you remember at the beginning of the Super Six, I mean, people were talking about Durrell as, like, the dark horse American guy who could come out of it and maybe was the most talented fighter in the whole competition. You know, Andre Ward was an underdog from what I remember. I mean, Kessler was the favorite, and, you know, Ward kind of really took advantage of that and really, you know, propelled himself
Kessler
up and kind of pound for pound echelon. Right, yeah, Abraham and Kessler were the two favorites. And Durrell.
Well, do you remember the poster? Like the first poster they made had Kessler and Abraham in the front, and then they started altering it as the Super Six like unfolded, so that they were putting the guys who are winning at the front of the poster and shit. Yeah. But, I mean,
Ward had that huge win over Kessler, and Durrell was kind of on his way to the same type of win over Abraham before that happened, and I don't blame Durrell for what had happened there, and in many ways it was unfortunate. I mean, it was comical as hell. It was one of those weird, bizarre, like, only in boxing moment, you know, he is an actor. But it was just like, but what's happened to his career since then, man? I mean, it is kind of sad and a waste of talent, and it's weird that the guy has come back and fought a couple times, but who knows? I mean, he just fought recently. I guess we'll have to see what he does next. But
Here we are previewing his brother's fight, and we're spending, you know, like a five-minute side conversation talking about his brother. But, I mean, you know, the first fight was not super, you know, like memorable. There wasn't really a whole lot that happened that was super memorable. It was pretty much like when Sakio Bika was having his way, it was a rough ass fight with him constantly grinding his head, using his elbows, etc. And I remember tweeting about it live because I was getting pretty like, it was actually getting to the point where I was really surprised that Sakio Bika was like still being allowed to fight and not being DQ'd. It was pretty bad. And if, you know, I don't even remember who the referee was, but Sigma is going like, dude, this guy's not even getting warned. What the hell? And, you know, of course, the response from Darrell was to hold, and then people started getting on the, oh, my God, he's fucking holding thing. And I'm just like, oh, Jesus Christ, dude.
Did they do a clinch count?
No, there was no clinch count video, thank goodness.
Where did those
Jesus,
guys
that's...
end up go? I haven't seen those guys in a long time.
I have absolutely no idea. I know those guys from back in the old school, too, but I have absolutely no idea where they went. But in any event, yeah, the first fight was not very good. And so it kind of came down to, at least the way I saw it, I thought that Darrell could have taken the decision. But what had happened was he seemed to, in the later rounds, just kind of let the fight get away with him. He spent too much time complaining about Bika's tactics. And it was legit complaining. But at some point when you realize the referee's not going to do shit about it, you got to take the law into your own hands, you know, whether that be with punching or, you know, don't stand there complaining. Do something about it, get yourself DQ'd, fucking whatever, but don't stand there and just, like, complain. So, anyway,
I think I scored it narrowly
what I expect this time.
Yeah, I think I had scored it narrowly for Bika, but maybe just because I've always been a huge fan of the Peter Gabriel song.
He was in Genesis, you know. Fucking Genesis, man.
Really? Where are
just
you at?
Saying, dude.
Phil Collins era or Gabriel era?
I mean, I don't know. I don't really have a strong opinion either way, to be honest. But I do kind of like Peter Gabriel in general.
You're not
chanting
Abacab and stuff?
No, but I like Peter Gabriel in general.
Yeah.
Kind of
probably
a
better
weird kooky dude
artist or whatever, but
yeah, whatever, you know.
It seemed like it was an evenly matched fight, you know. I mean, pretty sloppy, like we said. I don't know. I mean, it's intriguing enough. I mean, it's a 50-50 fight, I think, so that's a breath of fresh air.
Well, we have time for like a couple little more discussions, but actually also on the card that kind of filled him in last minute, like semi-last minute, is Deontay Wilder, the bronze bomber. It's a fucking god. The god. So yeah, he's fighting on that card. So what's your, he's fighting Jason Gabbard, so he's not fighting anyone that's really going to be a serious threat, needless to say. He's a guy who doesn't punch that hard and has a shitload of losses and a bunch by knockout. So, yeah, it's probably going to be a win by knockout and a continuation of Deontay Wilder's, you know, knockout thingy or whatever. But let's preach on Wilder for a minute there, Foley.
Clearly Wilder's best fight this month was against Dan Rayfield.
I missed that. What happened?
On Twitter. Ooh, it got a little bit vicious, you know, I mean, for once I almost kind of had to side with Rayfield on that, just because, like, he tweeted out basically, like, he's fighting Jason Gabbard, who, you know, shot James Toney or something, and then Wilder just attacked him for, like, 20 straight tweets, and I think the whole thing ended when Rayfield was just like, no, I don't know why my man Deontay Wilder, after being, like, just viciously insulted for, like, you know, half hour, I don't know why my man Deontay Wilder is so cranky tonight. I mean, he took the high road, but no, I mean, I do think that was probably more competitive than what this is going to turn out to be. But I don't know. I mean, he wants another professional fight, or who knows?
Dude, I'm just saying that if you're Dan Rayfield or whatever boxing media or, you know, quote unquote scribe. I'm just saying that you're fucking with a dude who had no qualms about messing with his family or beating the shit out of Charlie Zelenoff in the gym. So, yeah, don't fuck around, people. Don't fuck around. You know, like, I'm just saying.
Well, Rachel really didn't do anything in this situation.
Don't defend him.
Believe me, I don't want to, but I feel like here he was kind of like, it didn't. Make me a, you know, bigger Deontay Wilder fan.
Well,
I
have a serious question about Deontay Wilder, though, when it comes to the whole actual, you know, fucking boxing thing. Why are they not being more aggressive about how they're matching him? I mean, there's a fairly obvious answer, and that's because they want to milk it and get more money and blah, 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 but is there, like, an ulterior answer? Is there a different answer for why they're You know what I mean? Like, I feel like at this point,
probably
all right, dude,
not.
Step it up. Let's go.
I mean, we've been asking that forever, you know, and that's how it goes. It's just funny that the first, you know, perception is so bad that when he took the Malik Scott fight, who had just been knocked out by Chisora, I know it was kind of in controversial fashion, but, you know, he was hurt badly by Derek Chisora and stopped or whatever. That fight was seen as this great step up for Wilder, you know. And after 30-whatever pro fights, all of them by knockout, I mean, I think that was pretty telling. I don't know, but, you know, the last couple of weeks, just thinking about it, if Wilder does end up fighting Urmaine Stivern, which I think had been discussed, and it sounded like they were kind of moving toward that, like I think he's the challenger for Stivern's belt, I think I'm going to go with Stivern for, like, with a shocking knockout or something like that. Because I do think it's going to catch up to him that he just has not fought. Like, I mean, I don't think this progression is helpful, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that when he's in there with somebody with a little bit of skills and some power and somebody who could find his chin and isn't going to be intimidated by him, I think it might be a really rude awakening. But, you know, at the very least, we're going to find out what Wilder's really got. Because, you know, I think Stivern is beyond the Klitschko's. I mean, I think he's as close to a real deal as there is at heavyweight in terms of just, you know,
yeah.
I mean, it's not a good division, and I think he's probably the next best guy.
Well, I'm obviously very wary of jumping on, you know, like the Stivern bandwagon, if there is one, based on wins over Chris Arreola, because at this point I'm just not even sure exactly what that means. However, the way that he handled him was impressive, and, you know, you have to take that into account. But, yeah, I think that that's probably the type of fight that, you know, that makes sense, you know, at least in the next, I don't know, 6 months or so for Deontay Wilder. Obviously expecting just about any heavyweight that's not another Klitschko to jump in with Vladimir Klitschko at this point. It's just kind of like, dude, why? Although I do have to say that coming up here, this the Pulev fight, I'm actually kind of interested in. I don't really think he's going to win, but at the same time, I think that's Kubrat Pulev, that's an interesting fight, and he can fight, and he is going to come in there to try. Regardless, as far as Deontay Wilder goes, I don't really know what their actual plan are. Are they just like, what do you think? Are they just kind of waiting it out until Vlad's like retired, or what are they doing?
Maybe they just want to get up to like 50 knockouts, and then wait for one of those like 7-foot Chinese guys to develop and make that big mega fight in Macau,
like Dong?
Or something, and like.
I said they let the Dong develop, yeah.
Zile was that guy. I think
Tyshawn,
the one fight
Tyshawn
that needs
Dong.
To happen is Deontay Wilder needs to fight that big fat guy who got knocked out with a punch on his shoulder on Friday.
Yeah. Yeah, that was solid shit, dude. The shoulder knockout,
I want to see how quickly
dude.
That guy goes down. I want to see if it even takes a punch, or if it's just the punch is like halfway on the way and the guy just falls down.
Yeah, that shit was solid, dude.
I think that needs to happen.
Punch.
Well, that was great. I mean, what do we really want out of the sport? You know, we want riveting drama and action and all that. Or if that fails, we just want comedy, just pure. And that guy delivered that. You know, so
dude,
I mean,
I give him
a lot of credit for doing that.
You know what, though? What I'm saying is that guy, I don't even remember what his name was. His name was, like, Kevin some shit, dude. He was from, like, fucking Missouri or something. Regardless, whoever that guy was, what that guy needs to do, and I'm being totally serious here, is like, all right, dude, you don't have to do that. You don't have to fucking go into fights pretending like you're actually going to fight. You know what you need to do? You need to get a hold of some really good makeup artist so that way when you do go into these types of fights and you get hit on the fucking shoulder, some part of your face, like, explodes. And so it's hilarious, dude. You know what I mean? Like, let's make a serious spectacle out of this if you're going to do that. That shit was so blatant. It was like, oh, my God, buddy, come on.
Curtis Tate.
There you go.
That's his name.
There you go.
Jesus. Actually, the latest one that I'd read about him was that he was like, he also had like tweeted some racist stuff like last week.
Oh, great. Awesome.
So I don't know. Oh, what's weird is like, oh, he fought Dominic Brazil in his debut. In Brazil's debut. I didn't know that. And he got knocked and says Tate down 2 times in first round. So apparently,
yeah.
So wow, he actually got knocked down and like stood up and beat the count.
Yeah, but
so
if
maybe
you,
that
if
experience,
you click on
that
the,
experience. Should...
But if you click on the link, it says that the punch was to his ankle.
Yeah.
Well, dude, Zile beat Tate better than Brazil did. So I think by comparison, I mean, Zile's on a faster track. Am I right?
Shoulder punch, dude.
The shoulder punch is deadly, man.
Dude, well, that's
clearly,
like,
it immobilized his entire arm. He couldn't throw any more punches after that. I mean, it was just, the impact was, I think he broke his rib or something, maybe collarbone. So it's totally legit.
It was basically like Jean-Claude Van Damme's Dim Mac from Bloodsport. That's pretty much what it was, right? Death touch.
It seemed like it, yeah.
He don't look like
Tanaka.
Yeah,
I'd like to see him back on the air. I'd like to see him back on the airwaves at some point.
Yeah, well, I'm down to see him back on the airwaves if he's going to give a thumbs up to the camera and go, okay, USA. I think that could be solid. What else is going on coming up before? We got like 5 minutes left, so I'm trying to think of what else we got going on. We got that bomb Showtime card coming up. Adrian Broner versus Emmanuel Taylor. And then in the co-feature, Lucas Matisse. I'm not even gonna finish talking about that, but dude, they need to stop.
Against who? Yeah. It's not good. When is that card? September something? Oh, September 6th.
Yeah, September 6th. Oh, but actually that,
Roberto Ortiz?
Yeah. Well, that weekend actually should be a pretty good overall weekend of boxing, because that's also the weekend that they're doing the flyweight fights.
Oh, the big flyweight
fights.
Higashi
versus Gonzalez.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, that shit's going to be bomb. But the rest of it, the actual American card, like, ew. I think Adrian Broner is a fucking accident waiting to happen. Seriously, they're going to put that dude in with somebody that they expect to, like, you know, they expect them to just totally blow him out, and he's going to get, like, knocked out.
Fuck, it almost happened. One thing you got to give Broner credit, man, he's got a pretty good chin. Took a lot of big punches from Maidana and stayed up. I mean, went down, but got up, you know, didn't get knocked out. I don't know. Broner just does not strike, you know, he just doesn't seem like somebody who's really, going to put in the proper work to be great. You know, even if at one point in time it looked like he had a lot of the tools he would need, he just doesn't seem like he has that work ethic. You know, and seeing him blow up like he did between the two fights, I mean, he got real fat before the Maidana fight, didn't he? I can't remember if that was before or after the Maidana fight, but
yeah,
and just
remember he was on some, he was at some other live card, like a month before the fight or some shit like that, or like maybe it was 2 months, but he looked like big, and people were like, "Whoa,
right.
Is he going to be able to make weight?" And that was him moving up to welterweight.
Yeah, I think one of the few, you know, real admirable things about Mayweather, I mean, whatever you say about it, you know, his personal life and all that, he keeps himself in tremendous shape, and he's probably the hardest worker in the sport, you know, and he knows what he needs to do to get it to, you know, make his body work for him, pause, in order to, you know, compete at a really high level. And I think Broner, it just doesn't look like he has that same kind of work ethic, and I think that's a big going to potentially be a big problem. I think it caught up to him a bit in the Maidana fight. Some of that, too, is just that he kind of got rushed up to 147, and his only real meaningful win was against Malignaggi. And he was fighting a real big puncher who just seemed incredibly determined, you know, to win that fight. But, yeah, Broner, I mean, he's another guy. I'm not going to just turn my back. I mean, I'm interested to see where he goes and see if he can get back on a high level and should he win. I mean, like, personally, I'm much more interested in a potential Broner-Matisse fight down the road than I am a Danny Garcia-Lamont Peterson fight. You know, I think Matisse-Broner could be a great fight if they both look really good, on this next card, which they should.
It could be interesting, and I mean, you know what, as much shit as me or anybody could talk about Adrian Broner, everybody looked quite forward to Maidana Broner when that happened, especially, I mean, a big part of that was because it was capping off a really good run, but at the same time, you know, we were looking forward to that shit.
And that got that actually when we did like the preview and recap show here on Queensbury Rules Radio, that those shows actually got like a lot of live listens and shit. People were looking forward to them.
Yeah, he connected with the fans in some way. I mean, some of it may have been, you know, people rooting against him because he's just so, his shtick is just so, you know, agonizingly painful at times. But he definitely, you know, he drew a big crowd in Cincinnati last time he fought, and he seemed like a guy who was kind of a lot of, you know, catching a lot of people's eye and getting some attention. And you know, I think that's always good for the sport.
Yeah, well, I mean, generally speaking, it's good for the sport, and I think sometimes he does some shit that's like, I'd rather not be associated with, but at the same time, yeah, he does bring some attention. That's kind of tough to ignore. So that said, we have like a minute left, so we'll put it down, I guess, but we'll have to see what happens this weekend, I guess, whether or not this is horrible or whether or not one of us has a heart attack or an aneurysm or something like that, but we'll probably be back next week. But before all that, thank you again to Brian Campbell of ESPN for joining us. Always a pleasure and always a good dude, hilarious dude, knowledgeable dude. And thanks to my homeboy, James Foley here of Bad Left Hook. So go to Bad Left Hook, check out his work. Please go to Queensbury Rules, check out mine, and we'll see everybody later. Take it easy.